This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
11th, 2016, five climate activists shut down every pipeline carrying tar sands crude from Canada to the United States. One of them, Michael Foster, is in the state penitentiary in Bismarck, North Dakota. We will talk to the other four as they await their sentencing, and they will give the defense that so far no court has allowed them to tell a jury of their peers.
The valve turners.
When I think about the coming climate chaos, I call out, where are the artists? And here they are in action. Emily Johnson is a poet and essayist based out of Seattle, Washington. She published the book Her Animals in 2015 from Hummingbird Press. Emily Johnson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
What tar sands pipeline did you help shut down?
Annette Klapstein and I were in Leonard, Minnesota, shutting off two Enbridge pipelines, Line 4 and Line 67.
How did you learn where they were or what to do?
We, as a group, did quite a lot of research in the months leading up to this action. We wanted to make sure that we knew exactly what we were doing and that it would be safe. And, you know, there was a fair amount of scouting done, not by me personally, but by my friends. And, yeah, so basically a lot of research, both online and in person.
The media in both the United States and Canada, and there was media in Canada, of course, they're our tar sands, so to speak, but they all managed to put that word dangerous in their headlines. Was this a dangerous action?
So I have a standard response to that, which is, you know, this is something, we were very concerned about, first and foremost, the actual safety of it. And then, of course, also this accusation of doing something dangerous. But there are three main responses that we have to that. And the first one up is that these are the emergency shutoff valves. So if, you know, it is a problem, you know, these are designed and these are put in places where they're accessible to first responders, for example, not necessarily pipeline people, in case there's a wildfire or a threat of terrorism or something like that. They are designed to shut this equipment down safely. And as I believe you know, we also made multiple calls to the pipeline companies so that they could shut them down remotely, which they also do. And so if they prefer to do it that way, if that's safer to do it that way, we gave them the ability to do it that way. And in fact, all of them, it turns out, chose to do that at different moments, after a certain length of time with us turning the valves. And we, there was a pipeline safety expert who testified at Leonard's trial in Montana, made it very clear that this is what, and I believe the companies themselves referred to it as an unplanned controlled shutdown. And they do these on a regular basis, you know, for one reason or another. So there was nothing unsafe about it. And we took great, great care to make sure of that. The other thing is that it is the only reason that I was still nervous going into the action is that I don't trust the maintenance of these companies. These companies regularly have spills in the normal course of their operations. And in fact, between 99 and 2010, Enbridge had a spill on average every, I think it was 4.5, possibly 5 days. And those were the self-reported spills. So I'm sure there were some small ones that didn't make it into that counting. So it is the daily operation of these pipelines. It is the use of them, not the shutting off of them, that is dangerous. And then the other thing is that the most important thing to remember is we know exactly how dangerous not shutting off these pipelines is in terms of climate change. They're catastrophic. Tar sands, as I'm sure you're well aware, like coal, is the worst of the worst of fossil fuels. And it's the form of oil about which Jim Hansen said it's game over for the climate if we keep developing the tar sands. So we simply have to stop the use of the worst fossil fuels in the very, very, very near future, not decades, ideally not even, years, but months. And, and coal is struggling on its own for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with actually environmental regulations. It's, largely about economics. And tar sands, unfortunately, that's not true of that yet. But we need to stop using them, flat out.
In a meeting of supporters talking about direct action, you said you went through a door and was never able to come out. That's in that video. It's an excellent video on YouTube. If people just look for valve turners on YouTube, they'll find that. And it's a great meeting. Talk to us about that.
The truth is, having a deep understanding of climate change and of the urgency of climate change, that is actually really the door through which you cannot come out. You cannot ever go back through that door. When you understand what the threats are at this moment in time, then you can't unthink those thoughts. You can't unknow that, and it changes your life. And for me, what that meant, you know, was and still means is that I devote my life to trying to fight the causes of climate change on a daily basis. And 99% of that is, you know, wholly legal. You know, I help turn people out for hearings and write letters to their representatives and, you know, make phone calls and, you know, just about everything you can think of in terms of old-fashioned political organizing and protest and so forth. We do that. That's how I spend my days every single day, you know, of the year. But it's also clear that that's not getting us where we need to get because the urgency of climate change is so drastic. And we know that, you know, last June, Cristina Figueres, the former UN climate chief, looking at, you know, a consensus opinion by many, many, many scientists working with the UN, said that we have less than 3 years to ensure that the catastrophes that we've already started to see are not irreversible. And other scientists have said other things. I've heard 2 years as well, and obviously we're already coming up on on her number, meaning 2 years, so almost heading towards June again. And so we really have very little time before we set off mechanisms. You know, we've probably already set off some feedback loops that we won't be able to control. But, you know, with every day that passes now, we are running the risk of setting off others that would make it impossible for us to stop the processes of the Earth and its atmosphere that would doom most life on Earth. You know, we know right now our options are, you know, we might lose hundreds of millions of people and 5 or 10% of the biodiversity on the planet. That is probably the best case scenario, tragically. But we also know at the other end, it's, you know, the last time greenhouse gases overwhelmed the planet, it was the end Permian extinction, the worst that ever happened. It was 95% of life on the planet died out. And obviously, you know, somewhere in that range, humans will be among the missing. And this is not tinfoil hat stuff. This is stuff that scientists have been trying to tell us for years. And, you know, how fast it's coming, like, you know, obviously that's not going to start happening in 3 years. I mean, it will start happening in 3 years. It's already started happening. But the effects of it will not be complete for in the next couple of years. So we have to stop now in order to make sure that we save as many humans and as many species as we can over the course of the next 100 years or so, because we have to be on a path back to climate stability, or, you know, basically all hope is lost in the most overwhelming and really unimaginable sort of ways. And, you know, you and I probably won't see that, our kids will certainly see it and suffer. And people all over the world are already suffering. And people in Puerto Rico, you know, I believe it's 500,000 people still don't have power. And this is in the United States. It's completely crazy. You know, and people, and obviously that's not the worst of it either. There are Syria, Yemen, other countries, low-lying Pacific islands. It is already existential in many, many places. And it will be existential for everybody. So we have to do what we can. We have to step up to this moment in time. And that's the door you can't go back, because once I understood the depth of what we were facing, I also understood that I had to do everything I could to prevent it. And usually that means taking legal action of many, many kinds and a lot of time, a lot of energy and love. But also it does mean civil disobedience sometimes, because really throughout, you know, the last couple hundred years anyway, and maybe before that, who knows, nonviolent civil disobedience has been the only thing that has caused rapid, deep changes to systems that seemed completely and totally stuck. So whether you're talking about the abolitionists, whether you're talking about the civil rights movement, slavery, I mean, you know, any number of things, you know, as the suffrage, the way to get deep change in society, in many ways, is to just completely resist the system nonviolently in a way that other people can identify with. And they may not understand it when they first see it. Like, why would you do a thing like that? Why would you risk going to prison for years? But that opens up a moment where you get to tell them why you would do that and why, frankly, you think they should too. And so it's really about unsticking the system and making sure that people understand what the risks are of this moment so that they can act in some way rationally in response as well, you know, and whether that's kicking out their climate-denying electeds or whether it's engaging in civil disobedience, understanding that they have to have changes to their that they'll see changes to their daily lives, you know, many of which I think will greatly improve them. You know, that life without fossil fuels will be a much healthier sort of life if we manage to make it happen.
Can we call out to other artists to help get this message through?
We can call it to everybody. Yeah, this needs to be communicated in every way there is to communicate it. And you know, artists obviously have a really important role to play. I'm feeling sort of hesitant in my response because I'm actually not really writing these days because I'm so focused on this work. And, you know, with luck, I can find a little more balance on that soon. Yeah, everybody is needed in every way. And so people may or may not find a powerful way to express this in their art, but they can also, you know, help make art for protests and banner drops and things like that. And they can engage with their communities just like everybody else can engage with their communities and, you know, have a different kind of voice. And I think it's really important that we have everybody's voice in this fight because we all have the same things at stake, even though, you know, many of us in the global north and with some measure of privilege don't face the same immediate risks. And over the longer term, you know, everybody's voice is really important.
Do you think the threat of prison and long-term trials has helped or hurt your mental health?
I would say both. You know, taking action at this level and risking time in prison was very important for my mental health because doing something, stepping up in that way and doing something that I believe in so deeply and trying to shake up the system in a way that's different from the way that I try to do that every day, that's super important to my moral self in this moment in time. And so there's been a way in which it's been deeply satisfying. It has also been exhausting. You know, I feel very exposed. I'm a very private person and I've had to be very public in response to this. And, you know, I've written articles, we've had articles written about us. We have to give these talks and we have to do fundraisers. And of course it's also, I want to do it because it is about helping people understand why we would do this. But I do find it psychologically exhausting. And I've been doing that, you know, as I said, at the same time as I'm doing all the work I'm doing with 350 Seattle. And so, yeah, so in that way, it's been hard for my mental health, but it's been good for my moral health and my sense of purpose.
As we have to wrap up, is there any short message you'd like to leave with all our listeners?
Yeah, I guess one of the things I say sometimes is simply, you know, think about like when you're old or when you're dying, you know, whether you have kids or not, what will you wish you had done in this moment? We're not going to get these months back, these months and these next couple of years. And so think about what you can give and what kind of time and energy you can expend. And people often worry and feel hopeless and think it's too late, but it's never too late to say something, first of all. And second of all, at this moment in time, those of us who have any time to give and any, you know, energy, the risk of arrest, if we're in a position to do that, all of those things are so important. And now is really the moment.
Thank you so much, Emily. We've been talking with Emily Johnson, writer, poet, and valve turner, currently before the courts in Minnesota. We really appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks very much, Alex. Take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.